This talk is offered by Ordinary Mind Zendo. Ordinary Mind was founded by Barry Magid, Dharma heir of Charlotte Joko Beck, and is dedicated to her vision of a psychologically minded Zen practice adapted to the needs of American students practicing in the context of their everyday lives. Our public programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Our Western Buddhist approach to the problem of suffering has been very largely made into a therapeutic enterprise, so that we see the point of our practice as a kind of relief, amelioration, if not elimination, of the unnecessary suffering in our lives due to the what we think of as the kind of neurotic preoccupations of greed, ignorance, and attachment. And this kind of approach to suffering, which in a certain way sees it as a kind of unfortunate obstacle or add-on to our enjoyment and flourishing in life, puts at the center of practice this idea of our human development or flourishing. And so that, to caricature it somewhat, we can easily approach meditation the way we approach various healthy lifestyle choices, whether it's yoga or diet or exercise or reducing stress and so forth. In one way or another, even if we do not, you know, instrumentalize meditation in that kind of way, there's a kind of background assumption that this practice over time will make us happier and saner and make our lives better, right? I mean, it sort of goes without saying that we think that there are going to be beneficial byproducts to doing this, right? That kind of assumption is so built into the way we think about any kind of practice that we can hardly imagine what it would mean to have a religious practice that didn't share that idea. Yet, as Charles Taylor has written, the most fundamental challenge of the story of Easter is to see that it points to a value in human life that goes beyond and even contradicts human flourishing. See, like the sacrifice of Jacob by his father Abraham, the death of Jesus uh, involves suffering and sacrifice and a whole different kind of level of meaning. And it's one that our contemporary notion of practice, in a sense, doesn't know what to do with. Taylor also has talked about the way a certain kind of Christianity has evolved that wants to look at Jesus as a teacher, like Buddha, who taught a message of peace and love and charity, and that these are beautiful teachings that we could all ascribe to, and that unfortunately this particular teacher's career was cut short in a rather gruesome way. See, it just abstracts out the teaching. Love thy neighbor, right? Turn the other cheek, things like that. But doesn't know what to do with the crucifixion, let alone the resurrection. What we can say is that the crucifixion points to a real transformation or transfiguration of our whole concept of suffering. Christ's message is not about the relief of suffering. It's not about the end of suffering. It's about the holiness in suffering, right? You are joined to God by and in your suffering. Your suffering is not something that your religious practice or prayer or meditation is designed to make go away. Your suffering is itself your most intimate connection to God. It's a way of looking at suffering that ennobles it. It ennobles poverty and suffering and being downtrodden. It takes all the qualities that most people think constitute a failure in life and elevate them to divinity. In doing so, it sort of creates a whole new set of virtues and values. And we are often unwilling to recognize the extent to which these are in conflict, in contradiction to the ones that usually organize our life. Machiavelli was the one who most starkly pointed this out, where he said that most people really want to organize their lives around classical virtues of, you know, courage and good judgment or moderation, wisdom, discernment. The Christian virtues of humility and charity, let alone chastity, are ones that we may pay a certain kind of lip service to, but if you really want to flourish in this life, if that is your goal, then it's the classical virtues that you want to cultivate. Christian virtues are not about flourishing in this life, whether you're a Renaissance prince or not, right? And in that sense, you can say they bear a certain resemblance to monasticism or asceticism across cultures. The Vinaya that prescribes a life of non-attachment, having no possessions, having no home, having no security, in one sense, certainly upends our usual notions of flourishing. And yet, more and more as people, certainly in the West, join monastic communities, they do so with the idea that it is a particularly sane and healthy lifestyle to live in that kind of simplicity and discipline. And it involves a kind of redefinition of their notion of flourishing, but it has very little to do with a real renunciation of ordinary notions of flourishing. The Easter message of the resurrection and our redemption through Christ's sacrifice changes the meaning of our suffering, but offers its reward in a next life, or in the coming of the Christ again to this world to establish God's kingdom on earth. There's a strong sense that the early Christians felt that that second coming was going to happen in their lifetime. But again, this was a kind of upending of any notion of flourishing in this world. It was, how do we prepare ourselves for the next world? It became only very later, as far as I know, that the idea of establishing God's kingdom on earth through a kind of ideal community became part of some Christian sects. I mean, you get that, as far as I know, coming in the 17th century with the English Revolution and the beginning of Puritans or more radical groups like Diggers and Levelers, and then the Shakers, who go off and try to establish societies here on earth that will fully embody a Christian ideal. I think also we need to think too of a difference of an approach to suffering that is grounded in a sense of sinfulness rather than in a sense of ignorance. It gives rise to very divergent metaphors of atonement and penance rather than images of awakening or seeing things how they really are as the alternative to what causes our suffering. asceticism can be a common feature in both Eastern and Western monasticism. And it's unclear the extent to which we can draw a clear parallel between the notion of sort of universal human delusion and universal human sinfulness as what's trying to be eradicated through ascetic disciplines. I think these are different in very significant ways, and we have to be careful about not too facilely drawing parallels between the monastic experiences East and West and what they were aiming at. I think that the notion of suffering that comes with the Easter message is a good corrective to much of the therapizing, human flourishing trend in Western Buddhism. I think that we need to be aware of the extent to which we make our practice into a project of flourishing. Because much of what we have to encounter in our practice is non-fixable. You know, old age and death and illness are not going to go away. And the longer we practice, the more we encounter them, not the less. Our practice is not simply about how to become happy, but as Joko used to say, learning how to suffer intelligently. How do we learn to be unhappy? How do we learn to stay in the midst of the suffering of our life without trying to escape it in ways that are in fact self-destructive? So the Christian message that sanctifies suffering is another way of saying this suffering is not an intrusion in your life. It is your life. It is what life is. We need to not treat it simply as a unfortunate pathological disruption of the life we're trying to lead, but it's the very core of what life is about, and we have to find a way to live in the midst of it with love rather than self-hate.